The salary was much lower, the production budget tighter. Most disturbing was NBC's proposed start date of May 1994, when Jay Leno's contract expired. That gave the network 16 months, an eon in television, to see how Jay's ratings held up. If they cratered, Dave was plan B. If Jay rallied, NBC could stick with the status quo. Either way, Bob Wright would keep his two biggest stars in the fold. It was crafty work by NBC's lawyers, but a terrible deal for Dave. At best, he'd be perceived as the second man in on Tonight. At worst, he'd be the guy not quite good enough to get a shot. To me, a Golias bid was a non-starter. But what would Dave think? Years before, when asked about The Tonight Show, he'd said, "If I weren't asked someday to do it, I'd feel kind of sad, yet doing it, that's my worst nightmare. Maybe the prudent thing would be to let some other poor bastard walk into the fray for several months and then try doing the show." NBC was leading us to precisely that point, with Jay Leno playing the poor bastard. We were encouraged by how weak NBC's offer was. We could recommend against it without reservation. But even novice agents know that the first offer is never the best or final one. We could have shown up en masse at Warren Littlefield's office and called Bob Wright with Agolia in the room. Knowing how much Bob dreaded Dave's departure, we could have shaved the 16-month delay and boosted Dave's salary and production budget. I was a deal-maker. I could have hammered home a deal to get Dave his dream job, but I didn't do it, or even tell Dave that I could, because it wasn't right for him. A late-night show wasn't a one-off, like a book or a movie. His career hung in the balance. Sometimes representing a client's best interests means not getting him what he thinks he wants. The judgment part of the job requires knowing when to redirect a client's desires. In a conference call with Dave and Peter, we told them what Dave was eager to hear. "We've got NBC if we want it." But as we compared the offers for them, CBS won on every count. It also won on the crucial perception question. Jay Leno was pulling a 4.9 rating at 11:30, while CBS was languishing at 2.7. A 3.8 on CBS would make Dave a hero. The same number on NBC would be disastrous. For someone with Dave's strong fear of failure, that was a weighty detail. Flipping the frame to emphasize the positive and to spark Dave's competitive nature, I said, "If you go to CBS, you'll have the chance to beat NBC's pants off." Peter backed us, but Dave was still agonizingly unsure. From the start, two summers earlier, Dave had asked for my unfiltered opinion. I told him everything, even the ugly stuff, the negative gossip about him at NBC, the concerns about his style at 11:30, that agents usually edit out. On each call, I'd think, is this the moment to push him over the cliff? I decided now that it was finally time. I told Dave the Tonight Show was dead for him. It had died 6 months before, the instant Jay Leno took over. From that moment, Dave was no longer the crown prince. He could only be Jay's usurper. Their needling aside, they admired each other. If Dave big-footed Jay, he'd have a hard time living with the fallout, and with himself. His self-respect was even more important to him than his childhood dream. Dave didn't want to hear this, but he needed to. I closed by repeating our recommendation, CBS. There was a long pause. Then Dave said, "You know, it's every race driver's dream to drive a Ferrari. I need more time." His heart was overwhelming his head. Playing for the time Dave needed, I asked Agolia to come in over the weekend and start papering the contract. On January 9th, a Saturday, he and his seconds met with Lee Gabler, Jay Maloney, and Steve Lafferty, CAA's head of TV business affairs. I stayed away to preserve Dave's option to bail. We orchestrated it that way because, in a pinch, I might have to disavow any agreement they came to. Lee called afterward and said, "John's not looking to make a deal." He'd offered a few small concessions, but refused to put them in writing. A seasoned agent like Lee could read his body language. Agolia was following Bob Wright's orders against his own inclinations, and he didn't want to close. Agolia followed up not by faxing the deal points to us, as arranged, but by reading them over the phone. NBC was temporizing like crazy, which meant one of two things. One, they weren't sure they wanted Dave. A fax deal memo initialed by Dave and messengered back was binding. Two, they weren't sure Dave wanted them. They feared we might turn them down, leak their offer to the press, and drive an embittered Jay Leno to quit. At Peter LaSalle's urging, Dave called the one person who'd truly understand his dilemma, the one person with no axe to grind. Johnny Carson told him he couldn't decide what was best for someone else, but if NBC treated him the way they'd treated Dave, Johnny said he would probably walk. The king gave Dave permission to relinquish his long role as the prince-in-waiting. When Dave and I spoke that evening, Dave said, "Let's proceed with CBS." He sounded at peace. Before we could inform NBC, Agolia pulled the network's proposal. We guessed that Carson had told someone he had spoken with Dave, and the grapevine did the rest. To cover its ass with Leno, NBC then held a press conference to deny any offer had been made. The Late Show with David Letterman debuted on CBS on August 30th, 1993. I came to New York for it with my 13-year-old son Chris, who wore a suit for the occasion. Standing in the glass-walled control room at the back of the Ed Sullivan Theater, we heard the audience erupt when Dave came on stage. As the applause washed over him, I felt real satisfaction at having gotten him his own show. You couldn't know what Dave was feeling deep down unless he told you, and he'd never tell you, but he looked assured in a double-breasted suit, a pointed departure from his old blazers, and he nailed his monologue. Bill Murray, a client and great friend of mine, was Dave's first guest, and Paul Newman, another client and great friend, did a cameo from the audience. The show went over like a dream. Afterward, in his office backstage, Dave was characteristically self-lacerating. He told me the taping had been a disaster, and when Howard Stringer called to offer congratulations, Dave muttered that he'd call him back. Seeming embarrassed by all the attention, he focused on my son. Apropos of nothing, he reached into his humidor and offered Chris a cigar, which cracked him up. As we left, Dave caught my eye and nodded. Just once. Howard Stringer underpromised and overdelivered. Within 3 years, CBS reached an affiliate clearance rate of more than 90%. With 2 to 3 guest spots per night, Late Show with David Letterman gave the film business an additional venue for promoting new releases, which helped all of our film clients. Worldwide Pants became the producer of CBS's The Late Late Show and Everybody Loves Raymond, and Dave was set for life. In the middle of this long, tense process on Christmas Eve 1992, my family was in Aspen playing board games. I was going upstairs for a deck of cards when the phone rang in my bedroom. I was annoyed because Christmas week is a hall pass for agents. What now? Michael? Yeah? It's Dave. I'm sorry to call you on Christmas Eve. Dave, I'm Jewish. I often tried to make him laugh, but this was one of the few times I succeeded. He cleared his throat. I have something I wanted to tell you, he said. I was in a bad place, and you're helping me get to a good place. You're really saving my life. He went on in that sweet, generous vein for 3 or 4 minutes, a long time for such a reserved guy. I was stunned. After saying goodbye, I sat alone for a while. In my 25 years as an agent, through thousands of transactions, I had never heard so much heartfelt sincerity and gratitude. This was what I had always secretly hoped the business would be like. It was the last time it ever was. Chapter 2. The First Valley. My life is a story of three valleys. I begin in the San Fernando Valley, wound up in Silicon Valley, and spent the intervening decades in a valley I dug for myself. I was raised in Encino, a nondescript part of the San Fernando Valley, the most nondescript part of Greater Los Angeles. I loved Encino until I knew better, and then I hated it. We were on the wrong side of the hill from all the action. My father, David Ovitz, had grown up in the Depression, the son of Jewish immigrants from Romania. He never made it to college. He married my mother Sylvia, another second-generation American, and worked as a Seagram salesman, wholesaling to liquor stores in Chicago, where I was born in 1946. As the local liquor market flattened, the company encouraged its salesmen to transfer to Los Angeles, which was booming. When I was 5 years old and my brother Mark was a baby, my parents traded in our third-floor walk-up for a $3,000 tract house in Encino. My father was a sweet, hard-working, conscientious man who was fabulous with people. He kept broken cases of Seagram's bourbon, gin, and vodka under a blanket in his garage, and he'd hand out bottles to the local cops, the plumber, the laundress. Everyone got one. In return, he got great service and endless goodwill. But even though he worked weekends selling patio furniture in Santa Monica, in a good week he made just $400. He'd give my mom $50 out of that to feed a family of four, and she was always running short. Our one luxury was Sunday dinner out, usually at a Cantonese joint called the Samoa House. Dress-up occasions were at the Smokehouse, where my dad made sure we got in for the early bird discount. It wasn't until I was in college that I went to a restaurant after 6 p.m. My dad's dream was to open his own liquor store. "You need to be in charge of your destiny," he drummed into me. "It's no good working for somebody else." I remember him pointing to the display of Seagram 7 in the store, at eye level, the best position. "Power is all about shelf space," he'd say, "and to get shelf space, you've got to be big." But even his modest dream was out of reach. A liquor license cost $25,000. He wanted the license nearly as much as he wanted one of the big Fleetwoods in the window at the Casa de Cadillac on Ventura Boulevard. My father was not a superficial man, but it killed him that my mother's uncle, Sam, always had a gaudy new Fleetwood. Sam ran the two small Westwood hotels he co-owned with his nine siblings, and somehow he seemed to live higher than the others. He made my dad feel small. A big weekend for us was to drive 5 hours to Las Vegas, stay in a $35 room at the Sands, and take in the shows. The Rat Pack was on the marquee, and you might see Sinatra in his tux at the tables. "Look at this place," my dad would say. "Did we pay admission?" I'd shake my head. "See those girls coming round with free drinks? Seagram gets paid for that booze. Where do you think the casino makes its money?" He'd nod toward the crowds around the roulette wheels and craps tables. "From all those stupid people, Michael, maybe 1 in 100 leaves a winner." Once or twice, to prove his point, he had me watch him play blackjack. He'd lose a little, then quit. "Just remember," he'd say, "the house always wins." I absorbed the lesson, at least as far as gambling went. In every other way, I bucked the house, because while I loved my father, I hated his boxed-in life. Like many who'd grown up in hard times, he feared risk. My mother's mother, Sarah, was a blunt-spoken widow who lived with us for years. She played on my mother's resentments, telling her, "You deserve more." My mother took good care of us, but when the mood came on her, she was a fuzzy Xerox of Sarah, just as querulous and demanding, but less forceful. Sarah would gather me on her lap to watch Days of Our Lives together, and she'd protect me from getting spanked. She paid attention to me and seemed to think I was special. She was my second mother, and I felt horribly conflicted when she'd tell me, "You can be better than your father." On certain Sunday afternoons, my father and Sarah and I would go to one of Uncle Sam's Westwood hotels and listen in an auditorium with the other relatives as he gave an update on the family holdings. These were really just occasions for him to demonstrate his acumen and to receive adulation. He was a cold, distant figure, a dictator who'd entertain petitions and grant favors. We'd stand in the back, I think because my dad hated being there at all. Indicating Sam, Sarah would whisper to my father, "Why can't you be like that? Why don't you own a hotel?" She was agenting him brutally, and like Malcolm McDowell's character being forced to watch scenes of violence in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, I couldn't turn away. Sarah kept dosing me with this poison until I was 14, when my father finally kicked her out of the house. By then, her incantations, a dark version of the immigrant's creed that in America you can be anything you want, had cast their spell. Instead of trying to emulate my father, a kind and loving man, I would be what Sarah expected of me. I would succeed at all costs. She was depressed, of course, sunk in her own miseries, so I'd save her by taking extraordinary measures to reward her faith in me. Later in life, I'd go the extra mile for anyone who seemed sick or lost, but when Sarah left our house, she took the most feeling and hopeful part of me with her. At 9, I got a paper route and raced my Schwinn through the neighborhood. Then I asked for a second route, cutting my free time to the bone, but I always felt free inside my head. As a kid, I'd drive my dad and my teachers crazy with questions. "How can gasoline explode if it's a liquid?" When I was in fourth grade, I saw a scoop of melting lemon custard on the sidewalk of Balboa Boulevard near a Baskin-Robbins. The scoop was fast becoming its components, and I explained to Mark, who accompanied me everywhere, "It's ice cream, but it's not ice cream." I went home and looked up ice cream in our world book, and then I went to a Cornet dime store and bought a $4 machine to make some. It tasted horrible, but that was the kind of mind I had. Observe, analyze, then reverse engineer. I was a head shorter than my classmates and annoyingly curious, so I was bullied in elementary school. My father had saved me from older bullies once in the stairwell of our building back in Chicago, but he wasn't around at recess or in the deadly hours right after school let out, when it was open season on outliers. I absolutely hated that feeling of powerlessness, of cowering and being craven and hoping just to pass unnoticed. I couldn't bear it. I always stood out academically, even if none of my teachers took particular notice or encouraged me. I read everything I could, but my favorites were biographies of successful men, Andrew Carnegie, Winston Churchill, Nathaniel Rothschild. I also did a lot of drawing and model making. I wasn't a gifted draftsman or builder, but I'd construct model boats and planes in my room and entertain dreams of commanding flotillas and squadrons. If I built a fighter plane, I'd promptly draw a futuristic version of it, projecting what the next model should look like. Alone in my room, I'd try to see around the corner to what the 1960s would bring. I was always fascinated by what was coming next. At 9, I discovered motion pictures. 4 blocks from my house, behind a chain-link fence and a security shack, sat a place of mystery, the back lot for RKO Pictures, the studio owned by Howard Hughes. The first time I eluded the watchman and snuck through a hole in the fence, I came upon another world. Mounds of lighting equipment, cameras, microphones, and cables, and row upon row of false-fronted buildings, from old western towns to gritty urban streets. Hundreds of actors in makeup, cowboys, Indians, policemen, spacemen, and hundreds more people in street clothes who peered through lenses, strung lights, hammered and hauled and ran about until the director yelled, "Action!" and the fantasy began to take shape. The first production I saw was the schlocky serial Queen of the Jungle, but I was hooked. My parents desperately wanted me to become a doctor, but the movies became my obsession. I tried to catch every new release, and I became a student of the business, both the creative side and the bottom line. In high school, I subscribed to the weekly Variety. I loved Fort Apache, an RKO Western about the cavalry and a great leader, John Wayne, who overrules an incompetent one, Henry Fonda. I became obsessed with building forts and with the Spartan idea of the phalanx, the battle formation in which you're only as strong as the guy on your left. I was also impressed by an Errol Flynn Western where he drew a line in the dirt during a mutiny and said, "You're either with me or against me." That formulation, "You're totally in or totally out," became my mantra. It helped me enormously later, and it hurt me in equal measure because it didn't allow for shades of gray. Most of life turns out to be in shades of gray. When I was 13, I was bowled over by Cash McCall, an otherwise mediocre film about a businessman named Cash, played by James Garner, who lived in a hotel penthouse, flew around in his own plane, bought failing companies, and resold them at a profit. "I'm a thoroughly vulgar character," he explained. "I enjoy making money." As a negotiator, his stance was, "You can either take my very generous offer or go home and cut your throat." The concept of private equity was far beyond me, but I was struck by how Cash conceived a plan to fit his companies together into a conglomerate, then put his plan into practice with a band of specialist associates. I was also struck by his thesis that life was more than just business. I could run the world like Cash and still be home at 6 p.m., just like my father, to enjoy my family. He was a romanticized version of Uncle Sam. All the good parts and none of the bad. As a ninth grader at Portola Junior High, I got clobbered in an election for class historian. Losing this extremely insignificant contest depressed me for months. I could have accepted my shortcomings as a politician and folded my tent. Instead, vowing never to feel so humiliated again, I analyzed the loss and realized that I had no constituency. I needed to expand my relationships beyond the nerds who haunted the library and the ne'er-do-wells who snuck into RKO. The following year, at Birmingham High in Van Nuys, a school of 3,500 students, I put my analysis into action. I made friends with the chess team, the football players, the debaters, joined five or six clubs, and built a base of support across various cliques. It seems funny to me now, but I had no sense of humor about it then. I'm sure I came across as a brown-nosing kid in a hurry, but I was an effective brown-nosing kid in a hurry. I ran for 10th grade president and won. The following year, I ran for student body vice president. Because we were such a big school, I had to give my campaign speech to three separate assemblies. I got up to speak and discovered that I was extraordinarily comfortable on my feet. I looked people in the eye and pointed to them, calling them out, saying, "You can do it! And you, together we can make this a better school!" I personalized the battle and won easily. Each victory made winning more addictive. After I won that election, my father told me, "If you want to be treated like a king, you have to act like one." I started wearing JCPenney suits to student council meetings. I set up a program to bring in guest speakers, and I initiated a clean campus campaign in which we'd all get out 15 minutes early for every day the campus was deemed clean. In my zeal, I totally missed the signals from our student body president, Mike McConaughey, that I was stepping on his toes. It surely didn't help that when I ran for president that year, aiming to succeed Mike, I ended my speech by saying, "I would much rather be a president who has done something that could be criticized than one who has done nothing and can't be criticized." I won again. By then, I was working 8-hour shifts as a box boy at our neighborhood Piggly Wiggly, 4 p.m. until midnight, saving toward a car and college, and thinking about my future. Being student body president made me an ex officio member of the Encino Rotary Club, so I met once a month with the Rotarians, car dealers and insurance agents who'd made something of themselves. They were no smarter or more hardworking than my dad, but they had something he lacked, a college degree. That had given them options, and now they composed the local power structure. But I didn't want to be just part of a local power structure. 8 miles from where I grew up, across Sepulveda Pass, stood the mansions of Beverly Hills. I'd stare at them as we drove to family dinners in Westwood, a trip that in those pre-freeway days took 90 minutes. That was when I began to hate the valley, which lacked museums, institutions, a cultural center, any real stimulus for my brain. In the valley, people grew up carrying a football under their arms. I wished I'd grown up in New York, where people grew up carrying a newspaper. The west side of L.A. seemed like the best local version of New York, and though I didn't make the connection at the time, it was where Uncle Sam had his hotels. I wanted to live there. This grudge against my surroundings, this sense that I had been raised in the wrong nest, like a cuckoo's egg, fueled me when I began my working life. I always felt one step inferior to the people around me, and one step superior. I wasn't as creative or cultured as they were, but I was a lot smarter and more hard-working than most of them. Insecurity and ambition make a powerful cocktail. A month before I graduated in 1965, I heard about a job I actually wanted. After a hiatus of 30 years, the Music Corporation of America, known as MCA, was reviving its studio tour at Universal's back lot. They were hiring 10 young guides, 5 men and 5 women. North of Ventura Boulevard in Encino, people lived in houses like ours. South of it were vast homes that cost $50,000 or more. The local melting pot was the town's Little League, which my dad ran. Through baseball, he knew a Southside father named Herb Steinberg, MCA's head of publicity, who agreed to recommend me. I had a strong resume, but Herb's referral really helped. That was my first lesson in the business. Who you know matters. I was the only high school student MCA hired. Our training began in May with 4 weeks of evening orientation. In June, the studio set us loose on the 30-odd departments on the lot. Makeup, hairdressing, set design, props, costumes, electrical, and so on. A memo went out to the department heads about the young people in yellow and white seersucker jackets who'd be dropping by. The rest was up to us. The other guides worked from 9 to 6, but I came in at 7 each morning and stayed until 9 at night. Universal owned the last full-fledged working lot, and I walked its 400 acres end to end. I read and reread and underlined my studio guide as if I were cramming for a final, writing out lists of questions for execs and technicians, and keeping a notebook full of the answers. At the end of each interview, I arranged to come back to observe. I had carte blanche at the busiest film and television studio in the world, and I was getting paid for it. I spent hours around people putting up sets or taking them down or lighting them for the next take. I'd ask the production manager any dumb thing that came into my head. Why are you breaking for lunch now at 10 a.m.? It turned out that lunch was a subtle calculation. It might pay to take a meal penalty, enforced by union regulation, and skip the break if you could squeeze in one more shot before quitting time. Because after quitting time came overtime, when union members were paid at time and a half. And after overtime, that is, if you worked more than 16 hours beyond your call time, the crew went into a glorious, devoutly to be wished for state known as golden time, when they got paid a full day's wages for each extra hour. What I learned at Universal, the way glorious films blossom out of an intricate mesh of mundane practicalities, enthralls me still. I went in even on Sundays when I could wander the empty sound stages to my heart's content. I passed through Dracula's castle, the courtroom for Inherit the Wind, the battlefield in All Quiet on the Western Front, the Bates Motel from Psycho. I once disturbed some props on a TV set marked as a hot set, meaning one in the midst of shooting, and the director chewed me out the next day. I said, "You're 100% right. I'm new, I'm sorry, and it won't happen again." I post-mortemed everything and never made the same mistake twice. The heart of the tour for visitors was a two-hour ride on a candy-striped glam tram. I sat up front, wired for sound, and gave my spiel. As we passed the White House from the popular sitcom Leave It to Beaver, people oohed and awed. I went into the characters' backstories and how the show was produced. I might halt the tram and open Beaver Cleaver's front door to reveal the emptiness within, an irony lost on most visitors, or dispense tidbits about historic Universal movies such as The Phantom of the Opera. The backlot was overseen by Al Dorskind, an MCA vice president who tried to evoke the Golden Age by inscribing actors' names on their bungalows. If our guests were impressed by seeing Lana Turner on a door, they went wild when they saw an actual star. I chased after Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, and Lee J. Cobb, but they all raced off. I had better luck with the young Michael Caine, then shooting the Ipcress file. Michael liked to walk to the set or the commissary instead of riding the studio golf cart. Telling my friend to wait, I'd call out, "Michael, come say hello to your fans." Then I'd go on about Michael's fabulous career until I shamed him into signing some autographs. I was a great guide because I believed in the product. By 18, I'd absorbed a basic rule for success: love what you do. Too many people fight their job, a battle they cannot win. My supervisors picked me to run the once-weekly VIP tour on a deluxe single-car tram. It was reserved for the friends and favor recipients of Lou Wasserman, MCA's legendary CEO, and a man whose career would intersect with mine in ways I could never have imagined. He'd be the making of me, and in a sense, I'd be the unmaking of him. Some of us Valley kids followed the studios like boys in New York tracked the Yankees. I wasn't interested in the stars, but in the process of making pictures and in the people who were truly responsible. I loved the book Frank Capra, The Name Above the Title, which explained how the famous director took his writers to Palm Springs for 10 weeks and worked with them until they had a script they could shoot. The idea of sitting in Palm Springs with a close pal, drinking mint juleps, and making art entranced me. And I loved reading about Irving Thalberg, the boy wonder who became the head of production at MGM at 26. It gave me the idea that film could be a young person's game. All the foul-mouthed magnates who founded the modern film business were fascinating. Harry Cohn, Louis B. Mayer, Jack Warner, William Fox. But the one who interested me most, in part because I worked at his studio and in part because he had the most far-reaching ideas, was Lou Wasserman. As I learned when I scrolled through microfiche to find old newspaper stories about him, Lou was a top Democratic Party fundraiser and wielded unmatched power in show business. To hedge his bets, he had a senior MCA executive help out the Republicans. Some said he was tied to the mob, and Lou never denied the connection. If anything, he liked being feared. It was good for business. He began as a talent agent. After moving to Los Angeles from Chicago in the late 1930s, Lou built the town's paramount talent agency. His rules were simple. Tend to the client, dress appropriately, divulge no information about MCA, do your homework, never leave the office without returning every phone call. He insisted on dark suits, white shirts, and a dark blue or dark gray tie, and he'd sweep papers left on people's desks into the wastebasket at the end of the day. His credo was, messy desk, messy mind. On the one occasion I saw Lou's office as a tour guide, his desktop held only a phone, a clock, and a handsome desk set. Not one scrap of paper that could yield a secret. He invested being an agent with power and respect, for a time anyway. In 1950, when MCA insisted on half the net profits for Jimmy Stewart in a western called Winchester 73, it rewrote the rule book. There were back-end deals before that, but never for such a big hit. Winchester 73 became a moment. Cornering the market on movie stars, Lou swung decisive leverage to the talent and their representatives and helped finish off the old studio system. Later, he bought the Paramount Library of old films when no one thought it was worth a dime. MCA was everywhere, packaging a huge number of TV shows and taking up to 75% of their production costs. The company's reach was so vast, it became known as the Octopus. In 1962, after MCA bought Universal, the U.S. Department of Justice, run by Lou's friend Bobby Kennedy, moved against the company for antitrust violations. Lou could have sold his agency intact to the next generation, as we did later at CAA. Instead, he used Kennedy's threat as a pretext to break it up and scatter his top agents to a dozen boutique outfits. Sellers were balkanized and their power neutered. Brilliant! Lou coming on the lot was a visit from royalty. One day he took my VIP tour with his friend Mort May of the May Department Stores Company. Lou was tall and imposing in his big glasses and dark suit. He looked at me unsmiling and said, "How's it going with the tour? Are you enjoying it?" "I'm enjoying every second of it," I said. That was our last conversation for 20 years, until we went at it hammer and tongs over Robert Zemeckis' directing deal. I never reminded Lou that he'd given me my start in show business, though maybe I should have, just to piss him off. I worked weekends at Universal throughout my first year at UCLA. Because I was putting myself through college, where I was majoring in psychology, I had to work every spare hour. I returned full-time the following June, when the tour really took off. The studio added rides and concessions and threw up a building for demonstrations of stunts and makeup. After getting off the tram, guests could pick and choose where they wanted to go. It was like a mini Disneyland. I signed on for extra shifts. My immediate boss was the assistant operations manager, Tom Center. Tom was older, around 30, but we talked about movies all day. A few weeks into the second summer, he left to start a weekend tour at 20th Century Fox and asked me to come along. The new job was year-round and closer to UCLA, so I quit Universal to go with him. I'd be making almost $600 a week at Fox. At age 19, more than my father. As Fox's backlot was too small for trams, we improvised with walking tours around the sound stages. There weren't many movie fans from Dallas or Philadelphia, or from the Valley for that matter, who'd seen the infrastructure behind the magic. They were as slack-jawed as I'd been at RKO. A few weeks after our Fox rollout, Tom joined the Art Directors Union. "I'm leaving," he said, "and I'm recommending you for my job." To my surprise, I got it. I hired my college roommate as my number two and a dozen guides from my fraternity. We brought in 20 attractive sorority girls as hostesses. Business boomed. By fall, I was working 60-hour weeks while going to school full-time. If I had a midday class, I'd hop into my 65 Mustang for the 10-minute ride to campus and dash back an hour later. I parked in a corner of Fox's parking lot and changed out of my jeans and white JCPenney t-shirt, the college uniform of the day, and back into business attire. My bosses were never the wiser. At school, I was a total liberal, counseling my classmates on how to evade the draft. At work, I was the best organization man you could ask for. In my first innovation, I took a shot at the packaged bus tours run by Grey Line at Universal. It was a sweetheart deal for MCA, which sold blocks of tour tickets to Grey Line. But after I slashed half off Universal's block price, Grey Line agreed to divert a few weekend buses to us. I gave discounts to larger groups and threw in an option for lunch at the Fox Commissary. Within a month, the feedback was so positive that Grey Line switched all its weekend business to Fox. Al Dorskin, my old boss at Universal, called. I had cut sharply into his weekend profits, and he was furious. "Michael," he said, "you stole Grey Line from us. It's inappropriate, and I'm not sure it's legal. You need to stop." I should have been cowed. Al, bald, tan, fit, and rough around the edges, was Lou Wasserman's hatchet man. Instead, I felt a strange rush. "The last time I checked, this is America, and competition's a good thing," I said, "but I want to thank you for calling, and I'll certainly refer this to our legal department." I went to Fox's top lawyer and told him the story. He grinned and said, "You didn't do anything wrong, and you tweaking Al Dorskin is going to play really well up the ladder." It was true. My bosses were delighted that some college kid had shaken MCA's tree. Standing up to Al Dorskin taught me two things about myself. One, for reasons I cannot explain, I was fearless in confrontations. Two, I liked the entertainment business. I met Judy Reich the first day of my sophomore year. After registering for classes, I went to get a coffee at the student center and spotted a gorgeous blonde reading a book. There were a dozen tables open around her, but I walked up and said, "Hi, is that seat taken?" "No," she said, eyeing me like I was deranged. An hour later, without my ever having told her my last name, I was just Michael to her for some time, she agreed to our first date, pizza and a Hollywood jazz club called Shelley's Manhole. Great plan, but they wouldn't let Judy in because she wasn't yet 18. For our second date, I took her to a rooftop restaurant and spent $30, a ton of money at the time. Judy was an engineer's daughter from Beverly Hills, but she'd grown up in the flats south of Wilshire, the poor part of town. So she was a reach for me, but not totally out of the question. She was bright, a better student than I was, sweet-tempered, vivacious, and crazy about the theater. She dreamed of singing and dancing on Broadway. When I met her, she was pledging Kappa Alpha Theta, the big Gentile sorority, and dating a handsome but wooden fraternity man. I convinced her that an ambitious guy from Zeta Beta Tau, the Jewish frat I would become president of, could be more fun. From day one, I was content just to hang out with Judy, a first for me. She made me feel like I was working for someone other than just myself. She loved my drive, the way I got everything out of my days, what she called my last squeeze of the toothpaste lifestyle. I loved that she loved it, that she got me. We were in total sync. In the summer of 1969, my BA in hand after just 3 years in school, I married her. Chapter 3. Mailman. After graduation, I applied to three companies. William Morris, the oldest talent agency in the business, Creative Management Associates, or CMA, an up-and-coming talent agency led by MCA alumni Freddie Fields and David Bagelman, and the ad agency J. Walter Thompson. Only Morris called me in for an interview. I went to their Beverly Hills office in my $99 navy blue suit, wingtip shoes, rep tie, and white button-down Oxford shirt. I looked like a rookie FBI agent. Almost everyone at William Morris started in the company's mailroom. After a year or two, trainees were sent to secretarial school for shorthand or speed writing. They came back as an agent secretary. If they did well at that, they became an assistant, then a junior agent, and finally a senior agent. It could take 3 years to become a junior agent and four more to start signing your own clients as a senior agent, and more than 80% of the trainees washed out along the way. The way you got ahead at WMA was nepotism. Everybody was somebody's nephew. It was an old, soft, corrupt place. I didn't know anybody, so I needed another way to stand out. I told the head of personnel, "I have a proposition for you. I think I can learn all I need to know to become an agent in 120 days. If I can't, I'll give back everything you paid me." I was agenting him, and he knew it. He broke out laughing. That's the craziest thing I ever heard, he said. But I'm going to hire you. You start Monday. My salary would be $55 a week. I said, I'd like to start tomorrow. I showed up at 7 o'clock, 2 hours early, to learn my way around the building. At 9:30, we received our assignments for the day. A few senior trainees snagged the plum jobs as substitute secretaries, which gave them the chance to impress an agent. The rest of us piled into company Volkswagens to make the morning mail runs to studios, networks, lawyers, and clients. There were three routes, the Valley, Hollywood, and Beverly Hills. Before the days of fax or email, all business not handled by phone was conducted via hand-delivered memos and contracts. Our bags were full and heavy. There were 20 mailroom trainees, which meant I had 19 rivals for advancement. I set out to finish my route in half the allotted time. Mapping out routes with my spiral-bound Thomas guide to the city's roads, I played a game I called Keep On Moving. The trick was to avoid red lights. I got back to the office before noon, way ahead of the rest for any errands my bosses needed in-house. They dispatched me to accounting or legal, where I learned the ins and outs of the Byzantine Company. People came to rely on me. Soon they stopped sending me outside Beverly Hills and raised my salary to $75 a week. I was embarrassed by the low pay, embarrassed that I could take Judy out only to Mexican restaurants, which were the cheapest. You could get a 5-course meal at Casa Escobar on Pico for $3.95. 2 dinners, 2 beers, and a tip, and we were out for $16, slightly more than I was making in a 12-hour day at William Morris. But Judy gave me the line I'd use later when I recruited people to an entry-level job at CAA. You're investing in your life. I despised the mailroom, but fell in love with the world it served. Working for William Morris was a means to an end, to get close to our creative clients, people who did things I could not do myself. I had no interest in being a cigar-chomping schlepper, like many of the agents there, and I was repulsed when I learned the methods of one of our agents. He'd sign aspiring actresses just to screw them, then toss the contract. Agents in those days were functionaries, fielders of offers. They weren't respected in the creative community, and they didn't respect their clients all that much either. They didn't poach because they weren't aggressive. They lived by quantity of work, not quality. Two phrases you often heard were, a happy client is a working client, and if an offer for a crappy project came in, sell 'em, don't smell 'em. I aspired to build my own company someday, but that was in the distant future. I figured I'd be at WMA for 20 years. The agency had a rigid cash system. The mailroom guys used VWs. Young agents got reimbursed for their mileage. Rising agents got Buicks. Senior agents drove Cadillacs. Los Angeles had to report to the New York office, which still ran everything, and film was our prestige division. The big movie agents were on the ground floor near the top executives. TV agents were exiled a floor above. Even as made-for-TV movies such as Brian's Song were smashing old boundaries, there was no mingling of the world at WMA. Morris ruled in television, music, literary, books that became films or shows, nightclubs, theater, and Las Vegas. In film, though, CMA was killing us. Because there was no culture of poaching, we had no plan to reverse CMA's dominance. But the fact that our flagship division was our weakest created significant internal tension. One day, I was buttonholed by Abe Lastfogle, chairman emeritus and the living link to William Morris himself. He handed me a screenplay to bring to Warren Beatty's apartment at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. I needed help to find the secret stairway to Beatty's penthouse, the spot where he entertained Julie Christie and many others. The outer door was open, and I peered through the screen into a simply furnished one-bedroom suite. As Warren came to the door barefoot, in jeans and a T-shirt, I saw a woman in the background, identity unknown. He took the script and asked me about myself. He couldn't have been nicer. That image of a carefree man in the penthouse, shades of Cash McCall, stuck with me. Some 15 years later, incredibly, I'd be Warren's agent. Another day, I was asked to drive around Sam Spiegel, the renowned producer of Lawrence of Arabia and The Bridge on the River Kwai. He was nearly 70, but still virile. His nickname, in reference to his amorous technique in the back of taxicabs, was the Velvet Octopus. I was doing my best to make an impression, talking a mile a minute when Sam cut me off. Kid, he said between puffs on a cigar. You looking for advice? I nodded excitedly. Okay, kid, here it is, he said. Puff, puff. When you have the chance to fuck a girl, fuck her. Don't let her get away. A lot of show business advice turned out to be about how to get laid. We had a file room the length of a basketball court. It was lined with steel cabinets, the hard drives of the era, all packed with 70 years' worth of manila folders. I viewed those files as an encyclopedia of entertainment, albeit a helter-skelter one, so I helped the woman who ran the file room, Mary, with her mimeographing, and I brought her little gifts, a box of candy, a scarf. One day I said, you know, I'd love to read some of the files. She told me to make myself at home. Within a week, she was letting me stay on after she left. Then she gave me a key. While other trainees waited to be told what to do and read and learn, I entered Mary's domain each morning at 7 and every evening after work. For 10 weeks, I made my way from A to Z through the client files and the network and studio deals. I jotted questions for Sam Sachs, the head of television legal affairs, who was charmed by my interest and lent me a tape of a talk he'd given at USC on contract law and entertainment. I played it at home and came back with more questions. He gave me 9 more tapes. The legal office sat adjacent to the first-floor executives, and Sam Weisbord, the head of television worldwide and the top Morris executive in L.A., passed it on his way to dinner and again when he returned. He was a creature of habit. He stepped out to dine with Mr. Lastfogel, as everyone addressed him, including Sam, at 6:30 every evening. At 7 o'clock, the senior people took off, all except Stan Kamen, the famed motion picture agent, who returned calls with a second-shift assistant until 8 o'clock. And then the office was empty until Sam returned from dinner for another 3 hours to finish up. I planted myself at a cubicle where he could not help but notice me, spreading out my files so he'd see them. A week later, around 9 p.m., came the call I'd been waiting for. "Can you do me a favor?" Sam said. It was just a clerical task, but we were the only two people in the building, and he sure wasn't going to do it. My play was totally calculated and manipulative. I'm sure Sam knew exactly what I was doing. He also knew that calculation and manipulation are prerequisites for the job. So 3 months after starting at William Morris, I became Sam Weisbord's guy. I worked as his after-hours assistant without being asked or paid. I never went by his office without ducking my head in to see what he might need. When his secretary took sick and went on leave, he asked me to fill in. I was a terrible secretary, but a spectacular assistant. Because I struggled with word-for-word dictation, Sam would say, "I want you to take care of so-and-so and tell him such-and-such," and then I'd flesh out the letter on my own. Service organizations live or die by time management. I lined up the memos on Sam's desk by priority, subjects headlined in felt pen, and after Sam scrawled his replies in the upper right-hand corner, I hand-returned them to their senders. I kept his refrigerator stocked with carrot and celery juice, the health drinks of the day. I called brokers for tips on stocks Sam should buy or sell. In short, I made myself indispensable. When his secretary returned, Sam asked me to retrain her according to my methods. Though a compulsive skirt chaser, Sam never married. He was devoted to his work and to Mr. Lastfogel, period. As the day wore on, his two devotions clashed. Agents returned calls between 5:30 and 7 o'clock, after the clients came off the set and before they went out to eat. There was no way for Sam to finish all his calls before his dinner date. He had a bad eye that twitched when he was nervous, and by 6:10 the eye would begin to jerk and roll. He was the agent who taught me to think about creating work for the whole company. He was the only guy at William Morris who thought that way, but he just didn't have enough time to get it all done. At 6:20, Mr. Lastfogel, all 5'4" of him, would stroll into Sam's office. He'd smile at Sam and continue into the bathroom and shut the door. Then he'd wash his hands, saunter out, and nod his head. Sam would drop whatever he was doing. He'd practically put the phone down in mid-sentence and flash me a resigned look as he trailed the old man out. After I started working for Sam, I conceived a new long-term goal. I wanted to run William Morris. To expose me to deal-making, Sam had me assist a TV agent named Fred Apollo. I listened in on Fred's calls and soon was closing deals with the networks on his behalf. After 7 months at William Morris, when I was 22, I was promoted to junior agent, a title so demeaning we'd do away with it at CAA. My pay doubled to $150 a week. Though my promotion came in record time, I'd missed my own deadline by 3 months. I felt like I had to catch up before the world got away from me. I was assigned to work in the music department, where my job was to place our musicians on programs such as the Carol Burnett Show and the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour, and to cover their live shows. One night I went to the Forum in Inglewood to work a Sly and the Family Stone concert. I'd been told to introduce myself to Sly and take care of the band, then count the gate and make sure the money was right. In the days before Ticketmaster, music groups were routinely shortchanged. My credential looped around my neck, I wandered through the maze of tunnels under the seats, asking if anyone had seen Sly. Around 10 o'clock, with the band past due on stage, I came across a husky guy with a towering afro and a guitar around his neck. Sly. His eyes were glazed and he was nearly staggering. Realizing that if the show didn't go on, I'd get the blame, I took a deep breath and said, "Mr. Stewart," his real name was Sylvester Stewart, "I'm Michael Ovitz from the William Morris Agency." "What's going on?" "Mr. Stewart," I said, "you're a little late. I don't want to press you, but there's a curfew on the concert." It was a neighborhood ordinance, strictly enforced. "If you want to do a long set, you probably need to get going." He gazed in my general direction and said, "Oh, I'll be there shortly, but could you check on my band? They're in the Lakers' locker room." I wound my way through more tunnels to the locker room and opened the door. Jammed inside were about 50 men and women in various states of undress, shrouded in a fog of pot smoke. The nearest woman looked at me and shouted, "Narc!" and everyone scattered. I could hear toilets flushing. I closed the door, retreated to the parking lot, and drove back to William Morris, where I typed a memo to my department head relating my encounter with the Family Stone and suggested that my services might be of better use elsewhere. The next day, I was moved into TV packaging. In my home, nobody drank. When my father took us out to dinner, he ordered Shirley Temples for Mark and me and a Seagram 7 and soda for himself. He nursed his cocktail before handing it to the busboy and asking for a second one he never finished. I was the same way. I'd gotten drunk once at a frat party, and that was enough. I didn't like the feeling of losing control. Tony Fantozzi was a first-floor agent with an enviable client list, from director Billy Friedkin to Carol Channing. Tall and skinny, with a big fuzzy mustache, he was extremely charming. A few weeks after I moved into TV, Tony asked me to join him for lunch with a producer named Hal Graham so he could pass off some legwork. That is, the actual work Graham needed done, such as making his deals and finding talent for his shows, all of which Tony was now above. I was thrilled. We met at 12:30 at the Cock and Bull, an English pub on Sunset Boulevard with a famous buffet. I'd been at work since 7 a.m., a long time without food for someone with a high metabolism. I could smell the roast beef and chicken as I stepped inside. Delicious. I was desperate to get on the buffet line, but deferred to Tony, who lit a cigar and ordered martinis. Half an hour passed. My table mate's glasses were empty. Mine was 4/5 full. Tony called for another round. The talk became more animated. Tony ordered a third round. As people returned to the neighboring tables with heaping plates, I was feeling lightheaded. Tony ordered a fourth round. When the fifth round arrived at 2:45, my glasses were lined up like jets at LAX. Regretful about missing out on whatever pearls were to come, embarrassed, unsure of the etiquette, I stood and offered a useful all-purpose excuse. I had a ton of work back at the office. After that, whenever Tony asked me out, I grabbed a sandwich and wolfed it down in my car en route. To stay vertical through the meal, I'd spill some of my drink on the carpet or pour the martini into my water and ask the waiter for a fresh water glass. My admiration for Tony grew. He might return to the office a little wobbly, but 2 coffees later, he was full speed ahead. One day, Tony said, "I need you to help me with some daytime television guys." It was a strange request because William Morris had little to do with day parts, as we called them, except for one or two ancient soap operas that ran themselves. But the brass had asked Tony to rehabilitate Jack Barry and Dan Enright, the producing team from the quiz show rigging scandal of the late 1950s. "They're having a horrific time getting back on the air," he said. As I was just a kid when the scandal broke, I was dumb enough to see this as my big break. I had no idea how thoroughly Jack and Dan had been tainted. My Barry Enright presentations kept getting turned down, not once or twice, but 8 or 10 times. Perplexed, I nagged my superiors to contact the network execs who weren't taking my calls. They didn't want to get involved, but they couldn't blow off Sam Weisbord's protege. It took us nearly 2 years to get a show called Break the Bank on CBS, with Jack not only producing it, but serving as the host. Agenting was a commodity business. If you didn't sign clients, no matter what you contributed elsewhere, you were dead wood. I started by going after people no one else cared about, soap opera and game show producers, and especially serial writers. Daytime wasn't glamorous, but it was lucrative. I noticed that projects grew out of ideas and that ideas came from writers. I had a special respect for the people who created new worlds from thin air. One Saturday night, Judy and I were in bed watching Loman and Barkley, a local TV variety show. It featured a skit with a roller skating rabbi, a lanky guy who had fake payas, the orthodox sidelocks, down to the floor. He had us roaring. My first call Monday morning was to the show's office. I reached the guy who played the rabbi and said, "I'm Michael Ovitz with the William Morris Agency, and I think you're hysterical. I would love to meet with you." That's how a TV writer named Barry Levinson became my first client. It wasn't long before I got him hired on the Tim Conway Show, about as much as I could do in those days. Yet I was already meeting the up-and-comers who would later run the business. One day I ran into Michael Eisner on the set of one of our game show pilots. He headed up daytime at ABC. I asked him how he liked the show, and he noncommittally said, "Well, my wife liked it." So I sent roses to Jane Eisner with a card. Michael called me and said, "Do not agent my wife." He was kind of angry about it, but that sort of stunt got my name out there, and Eisner and I soon became friends. I've always had a weakness for smart people, and Michael was a smart, Eastern-educated guy who'd grown up on Park Avenue, exactly where I wished I had. He had staff to take care of all of his needs at home, and he was New York pale, and he toggled between boyishly awkward and slick and smiling, and he was even more manipulative than I was. And I fell for the whole package. After we started doing a lot of business together, Judy and Jane grew extremely close. In later years, our families would vacation as one big group in Aspen and Hawaii. Michael and I even had the same internist. When one of the Eisner boys disappeared one evening, as a teenager, Judy and I were at a Madonna concert with the Eisners, and Michael and I left and drove around town looking for him, finally locating him, naturally enough, at a party. My next mentor at WMA was Howard West, a senior television packager. His job was to assemble the right mix of Morris clients, writers, directors, performers, and sell the loaded project to a network. Howard could mold the fuzziest concept into a viable TV show, such as the Jim Neighbors show or Laugh-In. The agency charged 10% of the cost of every show it assembled, half up front and half deferred until the show went into profit. So if a show cost $1 million an episode, we'd make $100,000 every week. It was a much quicker way to cash in than simply representing individual clients. Howard did the deals with the network, and I'd do the deals on behalf of the production company or the lead actor. Sometimes WMA represented both sides, as it did on the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour, when we represented the producers and also Glenn Campbell and Jerry Reed, whom the producers were paying, so I'd be negotiating against William Morris agents for my clients and for my own fees. Those were the toughest deals of all to strike, but the experience would later give me the idea to represent all sides of the deal at CAA, working out any conflicts internally and raking in all the fees. Howard taught me how to bring clients into a package and keep them happy, how to mediate problems, how to watch over budgets. He always made time for me. Following his example, I had a series of trainees assigned to me at CAA. I'm afraid I was much less patient. He was a model for follow-up and presentation and how to think on your feet, and he taught me to tell clients the truth. Agents always get busted when they tell the easy lie, "You look great in dailies," or "Your script is fantastic." But Howard wasn't a client signer, so he hit his ceiling at William Morris. At dinner one night, he told me he was leaving to set up a management company with his friend George Shapiro. Later, he and George became executive producers of the supreme TV package of all time, Seinfeld. The news rocked me, and we downed 2 bottles of white wine. That was the second and last time I ever got drunk. WMA excelled at certain kinds of packaging, but we had nowhere near the clout of Universal Television, which basically set NBC's lineup. The big New York sales week fell in late May when agents peddled their clients' pilots for the fall season. With hordes of actors under contract,